This is the Cambridge Assessment International Education, Cambridge IGCSE, November 2022 examination in English as a Second Language. Paper 4. Listening. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number, and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the exam. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the exam. Teacher, please give out the question papers. And when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you're all ready, here is the exam. Exercise 1. You will hear 4 short recordings. Answer each question on the line provided. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. You will hear each recording twice. Question 1. A. Where will the first session of the art club take place? B. What should the students bring with them?
Listen carefully, everyone. The new art club is starting next week. If you'd like to join, come along to the first session after school next Wednesday. Meet me in the car park at 3:45, then we'll head to the playground where we'll do some drawing. The following week, we'll be going to the lake. We'll provide all the art equipment you'll need, pencils, paper, things like that. Just make sure you have a ruler with you. I'll explain why when we've set up. I suggest that you leave your school bags and any valuables, like your mobile phones, in your lockers. OK, any questions? Listen carefully, everyone. The new art club is starting next week. If you'd like to join, come along to the first session after school next Wednesday. Meet me in the car park at 3:45, then we'll head to the playground where we'll do some drawing. The following week, we'll be going to the lake. We'll provide all the art equipment you'll need, pencils, paper, things like that. Just make sure you have a ruler with you. I'll explain why when we've set up. I suggest that you leave your school bags and any valuables, like your mobile phones, in your lockers. OK, any questions?
Question 2. A. What does the woman dislike about her new job? B. What does the woman need to take to work tomorrow?
How's your new job?
Good, though I only started today. Seems like I'll have much more responsibility, and I really miss my colleagues from the last place, but I'm sure I'll get to know people soon. I just wish the location was better. That was the great thing about my last job.
Did you actually do any work today?
Not really. I went to a couple of meetings, though. I should have received my ID badge, but I forgot they needed to see my passport first. I'll take it in tomorrow. I took my driving license in, but that wasn't enough, apparently.
How's your new job?
Good, though I only started today. Seems like I'll have much more responsibility, and I really miss my colleagues from the last place, but I'm sure I'll get to know people soon. I just wish the location was better. That was the great thing about my last job.
Did you actually do any work today?
Not really. I went to a couple of meetings, though. I should have received my ID badge, but I forgot they needed to see my passport first. I'll take it in tomorrow. I took my driving license in, but that wasn't enough, apparently.
Question 3. A. What did the girl enjoy most about learning at home? B. Which subject was her father least successful at teaching her?
Which primary school did you go to?
Actually, I didn't. My brother and I were homeschooled until last year.
You mean you studied at home with your parents? What was that like?
I loved it. I mean, no uniform was definitely a plus. We were always having lessons outdoors, though I'd say that doing projects was probably the best thing.
Did your parents teach you everything?
Yeah. They run an IT business from home, so they took it in turns to give us classes. My dad's really into history, though actually Mum ended up having to teach us that. He just couldn't keep it simple enough. He wasn't so bad at science, though.
Which primary school did you go to?
Actually, I didn't. My brother and I were homeschooled until last year.
You mean you studied at home with your parents? What was that like?
I loved it. I mean, no uniform was definitely a plus. We were always having lessons outdoors, though I'd say that doing projects was probably the best thing.
Did your parents teach you everything?
Yeah. They run an IT business from home, so they took it in turns to give us classes. My dad's really into history, though actually Mum ended up having to teach us that. He just couldn't keep it simple enough. He wasn't so bad at science, though.
Question 4. A. What type of book has the author recently written? B. Where did the author write the book? Next in the programme, I'll be talking to author Marion Stanton, whose latest book has just been published. Given the title, An Island Journey, you might not realise that it's a biography. You'd be more likely to assume that it's a travel guide. But like her first book, which was a novel called The Pear Tree, it's a satisfying read, carefully written and beautifully illustrated with her own photographs. I'll be talking to her about her background. Originally from Scotland, where her first book was set, she spent several years in Argentina and had just finished this book there before moving to Canada, where she now lives and teaches. Next in the programme, I'll be talking to author Marion Stanton, whose latest book has just been published. Given the title, An Island Journey, you might not realise that it's a biography. You'd be more likely to assume that it's a travel guide. But like her first book, which was a novel called The Pear Tree, it's a satisfying read, carefully written and beautifully illustrated with her own photographs. I'll be talking to her about her background. Originally from Scotland, where her first book was set, she spent several years in Argentina and had just finished this book there before moving to Canada, where she now lives and teaches. That is the end of the 4 short recordings. In a moment, you will hear exercise 2. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 2. You will hear a student giving a talk to her business studies class about a couple called Sophie and Alex who set up a small company that produces raincoats. Listen to the talk and complete the details below. Write 1 or 2 words only in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
For my presentation, I've chosen to talk about a small company called Ponch, which launched in 2019. It's run by a couple called Sophie and Alex, and they produce colourful raincoats. I'll begin with how it started. On a camping trip, Alex was frustrated that the waterproof clothing he had to wear was uncomfortable. Then the couple went to a music festival where they were unprepared for very wet weather. They had to buy cheap raincoats, which Sophie said were ugly and unsuitable. They talked about the types of raincoat they'd like to wear, what they would be made of, and how they themselves could create them. And that's where the idea for the business came from. At the time, both Sophie and Alex had full-time jobs. She was working in the field of fashion, and he worked with data in a publishing company. They decided not to leave their jobs immediately, but to make sure they planned everything carefully first. They worked out how much money they would need to launch the business. Rather than borrowing money, they managed to put aside £10,000 through working overtime and almost as much again by budgeting carefully. They cut back on obvious things like eating out, for example. They talked a lot about the things that are important to them: art, good design, looking after nature, and being environmentally friendly were things they agreed on. Making sure that these values were clearly reflected in the business was a key decision they made early on. After 3 years, the business was launched and they produced their first collection of raincoats. The material is made entirely from recycled plastic bottles, and it is a much greener process to produce this than the material used to make a typical waterproof coat. The process only requires a small amount of energy, and it also produces less carbon dioxide, which is clearly a good thing. The other point is that where pieces of fabric have to be joined, for example, around the shoulders and along each side of the zip, special tape is used to keep water out rather than chemicals, which are used on many other waterproof materials and are bad for the environment. Sophie and Alex decided to work with an artist to come up with the design for each type of raincoat they produce, as well as the colours and patterns of the material. In my opinion, their raincoats look amazing. On their website, they state that they love material which looks bold, so this is what they have produced. Each design has a name, such as Midnight Ocean, which has a complex dark blue pattern on it. I'll show you some pictures in a minute. The other thing that I find interesting about this company is that the cost of their products is quite reasonable, despite the fact that the quantity they manufacture of each particular design is much lower than it could be. That was a deliberate decision that both Sophie and Alex made. They were much less concerned about whether their designs followed a particular trend. Okay, has anyone got any questions?
Now you will hear the talk again.
For my presentation, I've chosen to talk about a small company called Ponch, which launched in 2019. It's run by a couple called Sophie and Alex, and they produce colourful raincoats. I'll begin with how it started. On a camping trip, Alex was frustrated that the waterproof clothing he had to wear was uncomfortable. Then the couple went to a music festival where they were unprepared for very wet weather. They had to buy cheap raincoats, which Sophie said were ugly and unsuitable. They talked about the types of raincoat they'd like to wear, what they would be made of, and how they themselves could create them. And that's where the idea for the business came from. At the time, both Sophie and Alex had full-time jobs. She was working in the field of fashion, and he worked with data in a publishing company. They decided not to leave their jobs immediately, but to make sure they planned everything carefully first. They worked out how much money they would need to launch the business. Rather than borrowing money, they managed to put aside £10,000 through working overtime and almost as much again by budgeting carefully. They cut back on obvious things like eating out, for example. They talked a lot about the things that are important to them: art, good design, looking after nature, and being environmentally friendly were things they agreed on. Making sure that these values were clearly reflected in the business was a key decision they made early on. After 3 years, the business was launched, and they produced their first collection of raincoats. The material is made entirely from recycled plastic bottles, and it is a much greener process to produce this than the material used to make a typical waterproof coat. The process only requires a small amount of energy, and it also produces less carbon dioxide, which is clearly a good thing. The other point is that where pieces of fabric have to be joined, for example, around the shoulders and along each side of the zip, special tape is used to keep water out rather than chemicals, which are used on many other waterproof materials and are bad for the environment. Sophie and Alex decided to work with an artist to come up with the design for each type of raincoat they produce, as well as the colours and patterns of the material. In my opinion, their raincoats look amazing. On their website, they state that they love material which looks bold, so this is what they have produced. Each design has a name, such as Midnight Ocean, which has a complex dark blue pattern on it. I'll show you some pictures in a minute. The other thing that I find interesting about this company is that the cost of their products is quite reasonable, despite the fact that the quantity they manufacture of each particular design is much lower than it could be. That was a deliberate decision that both Sophie and Alex made. They were much less concerned about whether their designs followed a particular trend. Okay, has anyone got any questions?
That is the end of the talk. In a moment, you will hear exercise 3. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 3. You will hear 6 people talking about having a day off because there was a public holiday. For each of speakers 1 to 6, choose from the list A to G which opinion each speaker expresses. Write the letter in the appropriate box. Use each letter only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You will hear the recordings twice. Speaker 1.
There was a public holiday last Monday, so we didn't have any lessons. I really should have made use of the time and got my coursework finished, which I've been meaning to do for ages. If I'd thought about it earlier, I could have got loads done, but I didn't really think about what to do that day until I woke up in the morning. I ended up hanging out with my friends who called and said what they were going to do, and I just went along with them.
Speaker 2.
I'm usually fairly disorganized, so if I don't think about what to do when I've got a day off, I often just spend my time doing nothing in particular. But this time I really didn't want to waste the day. There's always a fantastic parade in my town on Independence Day, and I'd never been to it, despite having lived here for 3 years now. Some of my friends were even on the organizing committee. They were pretty busy, but we all got together afterwards, which was great.
Speaker 3.
On the 1st May public holiday, there's always a big street party where I live. This year, I was asked if I could get involved in the preparations for it. I had no idea how much the team have to do, both beforehand and on the day. I would have liked to help, though I had too much going on at the time. Anyway, I went along with my family and we all had a good day. My mates were doing other things, which was a shame, as they'd have made it even better.
Speaker 4.
On our National Day, Mum and Dad usually take us to the countryside for a picnic. This year, the weather forecast was awful, so we changed plans at the last minute and stayed at home. In the afternoon, I just lay on the sofa and read the last few chapters of a novel that I'd begun months ago but never seemed to have the time to get through. Then some family friends came round in the evening for a meal, so it wasn't like any normal day off.
Speaker 5.
I always look forward to public holidays as it's my chance to do as little as possible. I value my personal time because my job's fairly demanding. This time, I said I'd meet up with a couple of friends at lunchtime. We went to quite a posh restaurant. But other than that, I didn't make any other arrangements. But one thing led to another, and I spent the afternoon with them and then went to a party in the evening. I felt like I needed another day off afterwards.
Speaker 6.
The June public holiday is very much a family day for us. Everyone comes round and I cook a big meal at lunchtime, so it's always really busy. There's usually something going on in the village too. People take it in turns to organise something, though I've tried to avoid getting involved up to now. Anyway, this year my neighbours were organising a firework display in the evening and I decided to give them a hand. It was a lot of work beforehand, but well worth it.
Now you will hear the six speakers again. Speaker 1.
There was a public holiday last Monday, so we didn't have any lessons. I really should have made use of the time and got my coursework finished, which I've been meaning to do for ages. If I'd thought about it earlier, I could have got loads done, but I didn't really think about what to do that day until I woke up in the morning. I ended up hanging out with my friends who called and said what they were going to do, and I just went along with them.
Speaker 2.
I'm usually fairly disorganized, so if I don't think about what to do when I've got a day off, I often just spend my time doing nothing in particular. But this time I really didn't want to waste the day. There's always a fantastic parade in my town on Independence Day, and I'd never been to it, despite having lived here for 3 years now. Some of my friends were even on the organizing committee. They were pretty busy, but we all got together afterwards, which was great.
Speaker 3.
On the 1st May public holiday, there's always a big street party where I live. This year, I was asked if I could get involved in the preparations for it. I had no idea how much the team have to do, both beforehand and on the day. I would have liked to help, though I had too much going on at the time. Anyway, I went along with my family and we all had a good day. My mates were doing other things, which was a shame, as they'd have made it even better.
Speaker 4.
On our National Day, Mum and Dad usually take us to the countryside for a picnic. This year, the weather forecast was awful, so we changed plans at the last minute and stayed at home. In the afternoon, I just lay on the sofa and read the last few chapters of a novel that I'd begun months ago but never seemed to have the time to get through. Then some family friends came round in the evening for a meal, so it wasn't like any normal day off.
Speaker 5.
I always look forward to public holidays, as it's my chance to do as little as possible. I value my personal time because my job's fairly demanding. This time, I said I'd meet up with a couple of friends at lunchtime. We went to quite a posh restaurant. But other than that, I didn't make any other arrangements. But one thing led to another, and I spent the afternoon with them and then went to a party in the evening. I felt like I needed another day off afterwards.
Speaker 6.
The June public holiday is very much a family day for us. Everyone comes round and I cook a big meal at lunchtime, so it's always really busy. There's usually something going on in the village too. People take it in turns to organise something, though I've tried to avoid getting involved up to now. Anyway, this year my neighbours were organising a firework display in the evening and I decided to give them a hand. It was a lot of work beforehand, but well worth it.
That is the end of exercise 3. In a moment, you will hear exercise 4. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 4. You will hear a student called Luke talking about some research he did on shoes, including trainers, which are a type of sports shoe. Listen to the interview and look at the questions. For each question, choose the correct answer, A, B, or C, and put a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
Hello, Luke, and thanks for talking to us today about your research. What inspired you?
I was in town a while ago and noticed people queuing outside a shoe store. I wondered what they were doing, so I had a look online and found out that a new style of trainers had just come on sale and they all wanted to buy a pair. Then I came across a piece in a magazine about the incredible number of shoes that are produced. That made me want to find out more.
So then you went to the event called Trainer Exchange?
Yeah, it's a 1 or 2 day event, usually held in a stadium or warehouse, and it's for people to buy and sell trainers. It's incredibly popular, and at this one, everyone had to hand over £10 just to get in. I went when it was held in London, but it had been in New York before that and was going to Paris afterwards. It's been everywhere. The person who came up with the idea must be a millionaire.
And you interviewed some of the people at the event, didn't you?
That's right. I started with a couple called Meg and Tyler. They had a stall piled high with hundreds of pairs of trainers, all styles and colours. At first glance, not all that different from most of the other stalls around. But what drew me to them was the fact that they were a couple in their 30s, and almost everyone else there seemed to be teenage boys. I wanted to know more about them.
And you found out that it's Tyler who collects trainers, not Meg?
Yes. Meg told me that Tyler has spent thousands of pounds on them over the years. Apparently they live in a small 2-bedroom house, one bedroom for them and the other for his collection. When that room was full and he began storing them in the sitting room, Meg said he had to start selling. Some pairs are unique, so he could make quite a large profit from them.
And I know you're interested in the fact that so many shoes, including trainers, are thrown away. Why is that?
There are lots of reasons. For example, after you've worn a pair a few times, they can start to appear a bit dirty. Or, quite simply, your favourite brand produces a new design and you want it. But above all, it's that there are so many cheap styles that aren't produced to last. They start to fall apart in no time.
What happens to all of the unwanted shoes then?
Well, I went to one business called Reuse to find out. They collect unwanted shoes, lots of which still have their price labels on, and sell them on to other companies or market sellers. They receive huge bags with everything mixed up, and they have to arrange them all by colour, size and style, and match odd shoes into pairs. I thought that'd take ages, but they actually got through 3 bags while I was there.
What can be done to reduce the amount of shoe waste?
Well, one idea is simply to walk barefoot. Apparently that strengthens your feet and ankles, though it could cause other problems. I'd say, though, that people should have the option to buy shoes that are designed so that if a part breaks, it can be replaced, and it doesn't mean having to throw both shoes away. Also, I suppose people shouldn't keep getting new shoes all the time, though as shops are full of cheap ones, that's more of a challenge.
What are you going to look into next, Luke?
Well, I've been reading about some interesting ideas. For example, an engineering company that's developed a process to break down old shoes, separating out all the rubber and plastic, and even bits of metal. Apparently, the rubber can be broken down and then used to produce things like surfaces for athletics tracks or basketball courts. I'd like to understand how that's done.
Well, thanks for talking to us today, Luke.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Hello, Luke, and thanks for talking to us today about your research. What inspired you?
I was in town a while ago and noticed people queuing outside a shoe store. I wondered what they were doing, so I had a look online and found out that a new style of trainers had just come on sale and they all wanted to buy a pair. Then I came across a piece in a magazine about the incredible number of shoes that are produced. That made me want to find out more.
So then you went to the event called Trainer Exchange?
Yeah, it's a 1 or 2 day event, usually held in a stadium or warehouse, and it's for people to buy and sell trainers. It's incredibly popular, and at this one, everyone had to hand over £10 just to get in. I went when it was held in London, but it had been in New York before that and was going to Paris afterwards. It's been everywhere. The person who came up with the idea must be a millionaire.
And you interviewed some of the people at the event, didn't you?
That's right. I started with a couple called Meg and Tyler. They had a stall piled high with hundreds of pairs of trainers, all styles and colours. At first glance, not all that different from most of the other stalls around. But what drew me to them was the fact that they were a couple in their 30s, and almost everyone else there seemed to be teenage boys. I wanted to know more about them.
And you found out that it's Tyler who collects trainers, not Meg?
Yes. Meg told me that Tyler has spent thousands of pounds on them over the years. Apparently they live in a small 2-bedroom house, 1 bedroom for them and the other for his collection. When that room was full and he began storing them in the sitting room, Meg said he had to start selling. Some pairs are unique, so he could make quite a large profit from them.
And I know you're interested in the fact that so many shoes, including trainers, are thrown away. Why is that?
There are lots of reasons. For example, after you've worn a pair a few times, they can start to appear a bit dirty. Or, quite simply, your favourite brand produces a new design and you want it. But above all, it's that there are so many cheap styles that aren't produced to last. They start to fall apart in no time.
What happens to all of the unwanted shoes then?
Well, I went to one business called Reuse to find out. They collect unwanted shoes, lots of which still have their price labels on, and sell them on to other companies or market sellers. They receive huge bags with everything mixed up and they have to arrange them all by colour, size and style and match odd shoes into pairs. I thought that'd take ages, but they actually got through 3 bags while I was there.
What can be done to reduce the amount of shoe waste?
Well, one idea is simply to walk barefoot. Apparently that strengthens your feet and ankles, though it could cause other problems. I'd say, though, that people should have the option to buy shoes that are designed so that if a part breaks, it can be replaced, and it doesn't mean having to throw both shoes away. Also, I suppose people shouldn't keep getting new shoes all the time, though as shops are full of cheap ones, that's more of a challenge.
Mm. What are you going to look into next, Luke?
Well, I've been reading about some interesting ideas. For example, an engineering company that's developed a process to break down old shoes, separating out all the rubber and plastic, and even bits of metal. Apparently, the rubber can be broken down and then used to produce things like surfaces for athletics tracks or basketball courts. I'd like to understand how that's done.
Well, thanks for talking to us today, Luke.
That is the end of the interview. In a moment, you will hear exercise 5. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 5, Part A. You will hear a teacher giving a talk about a bird called the bearded vulture. Listen to the talk and complete the notes in Part A. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
This term we have been looking at animals that are threatened in some way and may exist in extremely low numbers in the wild. Today, I am going to talk briefly about one such creature, an amazing bird called the bearded vulture. There are many types of vultures. They differ in some ways, but share some characteristics, such as having a large body. Other features that they have in common include a sharp beak and excellent eyesight. However, unlike most other vultures, the bearded vulture does not have a bare head. In fact, it has feathers all over its body, which is its main point of difference in terms of appearance. So, where might you find a bearded vulture in the wild? Although they are rare, they can in fact be found in mountain ranges all the way from Western Europe across to Eastern Russia, as well as in Northern and Southern Africa. In these areas, they prefer to be surrounded by cliffs, although they have been spotted near meadows and occasionally around forests. I'll move on now to talk about their diet, which is something I find fascinating. While most vultures consume the meat from dead animals, the bearded vulture is the only animal, not just bird, which specializes in eating bones. In fact, between 70 and 90% of their diet consists of these. They eat a huge amount when they find some, then sit, almost as if they're asleep, to digest their food. They can do this remarkably quickly thanks to the strong acid that the birds have in their stomachs. You might wonder how bearded vultures survive by eating food like this, or think that they wouldn't be able to satisfy their needs in this way. In fact, their diet provides more nutrition than they would get if they ate fresh meat. Another point to consider is the minimal competition for such food. As I said before, no other birds or animals will eat it, and it has often been left behind by other predators. The eating habits of this species have led to them being referred to as the rubbish collectors of the natural world. In fact, it struck me that they're like cleaners, tidying up the countryside, which in turn helps to reduce the spread of disease. Now, Before I continue, has anyone got any questions?
Now you will hear the talk again.
This term we have been looking at animals that are threatened in some way and may exist in extremely low numbers in the wild. Today I am going to talk briefly about one such creature, an amazing bird called the bearded vulture. There are many types of vultures. They differ in some ways but share some characteristics, such as having a large body. Other features that they have in common include a sharp beak and excellent eyesight. However, unlike most other vultures, the bearded vulture does not have a bare head. In fact, it has feathers all over its body, which is its main point of difference in terms of appearance. So, where might you find a bearded vulture in the wild? Although they are rare, they can in fact be found in mountain ranges all the way from Western Europe across to Eastern Russia, as well as in Northern and Southern Africa. In these areas, they prefer to be surrounded by cliffs, although they have been spotted near meadows and occasionally around forests. I'll move on now to talk about their diet, which is something I find fascinating. While most vultures consume the meat from dead animals, the bearded vulture is the only animal, not just bird, which specialises in eating bones. In fact, between 70 and 90% of their diet consists of these. They eat a huge amount when they find some, then sit, almost as if they're asleep, to digest their food. They can do this remarkably quickly thanks to the strong acid that the birds have in their stomachs. You might wonder how bearded vultures survive by eating food like this, or think that they wouldn't be able to satisfy their needs in this way. In fact, their diet provides more nutrition than they would get if they ate fresh meat. Another point to consider is the minimal competition for such food. As I said before, no other birds or animals will eat it, and it has often been left behind by other predators. The eating habits of this species have led to them being referred to as the rubbish collectors of the natural world. In fact, it struck me that they're like cleaners, tidying up the countryside, which in turn helps to reduce the spread of disease. Now, before I continue, has anyone got any questions?
Part B. Now listen to a conversation between two students about protecting the bearded vulture and complete the sentences in Part B. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the conversation twice.
Jenny, have you looked at the websites on bearded vulture conservation?
Yeah, yesterday. I had no idea it's been so successful in the Alps, the mountains in Western Europe. Apparently, in the early 20th century, bearded vultures were hunted so much that they became extinct. There were literally none left. Local people used to think bearded vultures were dangerous, but they now recognise that this isn't the case.
Yes, their attitude isn't what it once was, luckily for these birds. And it seems these people have a lot of enthusiasm for the conservation projects, which means there are several hundred birds in that region once again.
Great, isn't it? I guess it helps that farmers have a good level of confidence that the birds won't come near them or attack their animals. Relatively few conflicts like this are reported. Imagine if these wildlife organisations were trying to protect wolves or bears. The level of cooperation with local people would be minimal.
Absolutely.
One thing the organisations are doing is working with energy companies in the area to avoid a particular problem. Apparently, one or two birds are killed each year by accidentally flying into power lines. But it's easy to prevent this by installing objects on them, like plastic balls, so they become more visible to the birds.
Ah, I've seen those, but didn't realise what they were for.
What else did you find out?
I've got my notes here. Oh, yes. There are some myths or stories associated with bearded vultures in various countries around the world. So, in one country, for example, they're seen as a symbol of luck or happiness, and it's believed that if its shadow passes over you, you'll become the country's ruler. But shooting one means you'll have a much less fortunate outcome.
So I guess they weren't hunted there much, and seeing one would be more common.
Exactly.
The only other thing I noted down was that despite all these conservation projects, the number of bearded vultures around the world is going down. That's such a shame.
Why is that happening? Is it due to food availability or something like that?
People often think poison is to blame, but overall, it's down to human development. Basically, there are too many of us and we're continually taking over the spaces where they live.
Well, let's hope that changes in the near future.
Now you will hear the conversation again.
Jenny, have you looked at the websites on bearded vulture conservation?
Yeah, yesterday. I had no idea it's been so successful in the Alps, the mountains in Western Europe. Apparently, in the early 20th century, bearded vultures were hunted so much that they became extinct. There were literally none left. Local people used to think bearded vultures were dangerous, but they now recognise that this isn't the case.
Yes, their attitude isn't what it once was, luckily for these birds. And it seems these people have a lot of enthusiasm for the conservation projects, which means there are several hundred birds in that region once again.
Great, isn't it? I guess it helps that farmers have a good level of confidence that the birds won't come near them or attack their animals. Relatively few conflicts like this are reported. Imagine if these wildlife organisations were trying to protect wolves or bears. The level of cooperation with local people would be minimal.
Absolutely.
One thing the organisations are doing is working with energy companies in the area to avoid a particular problem. Apparently, one or two birds are killed each year by accidentally flying into power lines. But it's easy to prevent this by installing objects on them, like plastic balls, so they become more visible to the birds.
Ah, I've seen those, but didn't realise what they were for.
What else did you find out?
I've got my notes here. Oh, yes. There are some myths or stories associated with bearded vultures in various countries around the world. So, in one country, for example, they're seen as a symbol of luck or happiness, and it's believed that if its shadow passes over you, you'll become the country's ruler. But shooting one means you'll have a much less fortunate outcome.
So I guess they weren't hunted there much, and seeing one would be more common.
Exactly.
The only other thing I noted down was that despite all these conservation projects, the number of bearded vultures around the world is going down. That's such a shame.
Why is that happening? Is it due to food availability or something like that?
People often think poison is to blame. But overall, it's down to human development. Basically, there are too many of us and we're continually taking over the spaces where they live.
Well, let's hope that changes in the near future.
That is the end of exercise 5 and of the exam. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers.